Before we get started with this week's podcast, just a quick message to say that you'll notice a slight change in audio quality in the second half of this podcast, which was discovered in post-production. You'll still be able to hear everything, but just a heads up, it's us, not you. And anyway, now, on with the show. Hello and welcome to another edition to FinTech and Beyond, the podcast brought to you by Tribe. On this week's episode of To FinTech and Beyond, joining us is Erica Stanford, founder of the Crypto Curry Club and author of Crypto Wars, as we dissect the question, cryptocurrencies, hero or villain? Hi, welcome to another episode of To FinTech and Beyond, the Tribe podcast focus on discussing some of the most interesting problems in the FinTech and payment space today. Today, I have the joy of welcoming Erica Stanford. Erica, hello.
Hey, Alex, thank you very much for having me. Excited to be here.
Not at all. I guess, today's podcast, Cryptocurrencies, Hero or Villain, I think we'll get into the trials, tribulations and exciting elements of that over the coming sort of 30 minutes or so. But before we do, it'd be great to have sort of 30 seconds on Erica, you know, who you are, you know, and where you've been, I guess, over the past few years.
Sure, no, well, thanks. So I'm Erica Stanford. I run something called the Crypto Curry Club, which started in 2018. At the time, there wasn't really much of a crypto community at all, and I wanted to meet other people and find out what else was happening. So we started running networking events over curry and drinks, and they sort of grew quite a lot. So I believe that's the main crypto community in the UK now. I spent all of lockdown at the behest of a publisher writing a book called Crypto Wars, Fake Deaths, Missing Billions and Industry Disruption about the biggest hacks and scams in crypto. And I work part-time at CMS, the main law firm in the space, as a sort of fintech specialist advising on crypto and fintech things.
Wow. So other than knowing what good curries are there in London, we can expect to hear a lot about the crypto space there. Right. Okay. So let's if we get started, I think before we look forward, I think it's worth taking a step back and sort of trying to establish where we are with crypto today. I think, you know, we've come a long way since white papers, but you know, there's obviously still a long way to go. I'd be interested to understand a bit more about where we are today, what that looks like, and sort of, I guess, where we've come from to some extent.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, the crypto space has grown massively from when it started as really just sort of a technological idea and a bit of a way of being seen to get around sort of state-imposed control when digital currencies first launched sort of in and before 2009, to sort of getting a slow path of adoption. And then we sort of the first sort of main big, you know, slightly over the top bubble in 2016 to 2018, where you saw thousands of projects and companies sort of get on the bandwagon and realize how easy it was to launch their own cryptocurrency out of thin air and make money for it. So you had this whole sort of opportunistic phase of thousands of projects of cropping up that for the most part offered no value or worth whatsoever. And since then, 98% of those have crashed or a scam or lost their value for their investors. And that phase was sort of a key defining phase in the crypto period, I'd argue. And then we went through a bit of a dip again. And then, you know, only recently now just saw another sort of, I'd call it bubble. Some people would call it highs in the crypto space. And, you know, you've seen not only new crypto tokens launch, but also now getting into the whole digital art and NFTs and so forth. And, you know, now we're seeing a bit of a crash again due to some more questionable technologies. But what's really nice now is sort of aside from the highs and lows, what one has in crypto is a lot of really cool, just core basic use cases that often get overlooked, such as just being able to send digital money basically instantly, basically for free across borders, you know, without needing to rely on third parties or banks or intermediaries. So crypto opens up a whole load of opportunities for people around the world, you know, either those who don't have access to traditional banking or just those who want to send micropayments sort of in really tiny amounts that isn't viable or feasible to send using fiat currency because it costs too much to do so. So you've got a lot of the sort of the core practical use cases now starting to come out and be used. And we've also seen a lot more sort of institutional adoption and interest in crypto, and even some of the really traditional slow moving banks and sort of corporate and retail firms that had been hesitant, or you know, had just seen, oh, it's all bad, or it's all a scam, now actively wanting to learn about crypto and seeing how they can get into it, and even in some cases seeing that they've lost market share to some of the newer crypto companies, so now seeing that they need to have crypto product offerings, for example. So the space is evolving super 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 quickly, and it feels like almost every day, or at least every week, me or, you know, either through the carriers or through the law firm, or say we'll get an email or someone reaching out from somebody who's just left a, you know, super senior position, it's, you know, founder of bank or C-suite of you know, big global corporate or so forth, to work in a crypto startup because they see that other industries are just moving too slowly, and that innovation is sort of, you know, leaving them behind, and they're more excited by the crypto space. So, and they're of course bringing their contacts and expertise and experiences with them.
Yeah, I think to that very point of evolution, you know, I think I saw at the weekend a $300 million payment go through, and it cost them 12 cents as opposed to whatever percentage.
It's changing super fast. And on the other side, one can send fractions of 1p for basically for free, which just simply can't be done sort of without a cost using fiat currency.
Completely. I'm interested. I think you were sort of referring to it earlier as you were talking there, like every time we sort of see a dip or a sort of closure of a number of, let's call it, non necessarily righteous projects, for want of a better term. But why do you think we then see some sort of stability and evolution or innovation that comes off the back of that? Like both times you sort of referred to the dip sort of just previously and sort of back in 2018, we sort of saw this growth of sustained innovation and sustained product. Do you think there's a reason for it, or?
I think the good projects and the sustained innovation, you know, from what I can see and knowing a bunch of those companies, that goes on the whole time. And there's a number of companies, sort of companies offering secure crypto custody or security solutions or whatever they're working on, that basically keep plowing on quietly in the background and only make peeps when they have new sort of product launches. But other than that, just keep sort of working on, you know, regardless of prices up, prices down. I think when the price goes up a lot of focus shifts to that, you know, often I'd say too much focus shifts to that. And you know, some of the crashes of you know, either prices of crypto or of certain products, you know, many people see those coming. In some cases, they're inevitable. A lot, you know, there's a lot of good crypto companies out there, and there's a lot of ones that aren't good, that don't have the best technology, that haven't done things like cybersecurity checks or have the correct sort of security setups in place. So, you know, in some cases it's almost inevitable that they're going to get hacked because you've got lots of digital money stored in one place and, you know, hackers going, well, thank you very much, I'll help myself to that. So a lot of the collapses and problems, you know, in some cases are inevitable and are also, you know, in many cases due to those specific platforms not having the correct security setups or doing the correct security checks that they could have done had they really wanted to. So, you know, I think a lot of the crashes, you know, that scares people, then people sell out and the crashes the price of Bitcoin. But I don't think that necessarily affects the wider picture of the market, whereby the core technology of the better protocols and the better companies is still going on. So I think it's just a case of the good innovation that's happening and sort of the core technologies that are just quietly focusing on building themselves. I think it's just that maybe when, you know, prices have crashed a bit and it's trading a bit more flatly, there's less media hype about Bitcoin prices up, Bitcoin prices down, or all of the highs and lows. So it might just be that they get a little bit more focus in those times.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's anything to do with them suddenly coming out in those times.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? It's almost death by social media. Everyone's, you know, whether it's Elon Musk or whoever it is on Twitter that decides to focus on the price of a particular coin or asset class, I guess. But anyway.
Well, and that's one of the core problems in crypto, I'd argue, because it's still, I mean, it's, you know, you're talking about an asset class that's in the trillions, but it's still relatively small, relatively new, you know, relatively low key, and highly, highly volatile. You know, it's quite easy as numerous individuals, but, you know, specific billionaires in general have demonstrated, it's quite easy to swing the price of Bitcoin or for cryptocurrencies by, you know, up to 30-35% just like that.
Yeah.
So that's one of the problems in crypto, how easy, you know, individuals can influence it. But of course, the media likes that, and that's what the media cottons onto.
Yeah, and I think, you know, some of it comes down to social investing, isn't it? We were all holed up for 2 years with nothing to spend our money on. We all decided to become a day trader, and then actually you garner your news from Twitter as opposed to informed research or quantitative data.
Yeah, I mean, that is part of the problem in the space. And, you know, there's a lot of super, super smart people in crypto, but then there's also a lot of people invested in either prices going up or down using social media to influence prices. You know, one can't deny that happens. That happens, and that does affect. And then a lot of people lose a lot of money by trusting that or by trusting certain platforms where had they perhaps done more advanced checks, which to a degree relies on understanding how technology works, they perhaps wouldn't have trusted their money to those platforms or projects.
Yeah. So we'll have one last, slightly negative discussion, then we'll move on to the positives, I think. But yeah. Obviously, within the book, you talk a lot about some of the scams and things like that. I'd be interested, you know, without selling yourself short, without, you know, people should go and buy the book. They shouldn't just listen to this podcast.
But please do go and buy the book.
Yeah. Please do. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm sure we can put a few copies up for people that email us in. We'll worry about that afterwards. But I think it'd be great to understand a bit about some of the complications, some of the past, some of the interesting stories you were able to uncover. You know, are you able to talk about that a bit? Go. Sorry.
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, there's crypto has been famous for sort of some of the hacks and scams. And there's a few factors. You've got some crypto platforms that just, you know, frankly shouldn't have raised the amount of money they did, and shouldn't have been able to get away with storing the amount of investors' money that they did, you know. And there's been a few of those platforms that, you know, once they accumulated enough money, you know, and they didn't store it in the safe ways that they said they would store it, or they didn't do what they said they would go against to do, and basically went, well, thank you for all your money and bye. You know, that's happened a few times. There's been other platforms that, again, made, you know, perhaps nice claims about how securely they were going to store investors' money and didn't store it that securely, which was, you know, promptly shown because they were targeted by hackers. And yes, hackers are getting sophisticated. You've got some state-sponsored hackers that are incredibly sophisticated and incredibly smart and, you know, have, you know, the best tools available. But nonetheless, you know, there's also very good cybersecurity solutions available. And you talk to the guys in the cybersecurity space, and, you know, they'll be the first to say that there's an awful lot that more that those platforms could have done to avoid it being hacked. So, you know, where does the fault lie? Big question. So that's one of the aspects, you know, and yes, lots of hackers, also lots of exchanges not being as secure as they should be and could be. And then you've got a lot of projects, you know, especially in 2016 to 2018, but I'd say we're seeing it now again in the NFT phase, and you've still got a lot of these new products launching. There's a lot of opportunists in the space that you know, have seen, well, you've got this shiny new digital money that, you know, price goes up, price goes down, lots of people making lots of money. We can persuade lots of people that make lots of money, and just taking advantage of the space and, you know, offering things to people that, you know, if it were in sort of the traditional world and they were going to traditional VCs or traditional investors or banks or even friends or family, you know, there's frankly probably no way that they would raise that money. But because it's a crypto space, they come out with these glorified offerings, and it's not, you know, not regulated enough, so they basically have been getting away with making lots of big claims and people fall for that. So that's part of the problem. And then you do have organized scams, you know, scams that are run by, either criminal organizations, in some cases you've got mafia involvement, you know, where you've got really sophisticated guys running, you know, what are scams or Ponzi schemes from the start, you know, where their sole intention is to get as big as possible and to scam as many people as possible. And, you know, that takes all forms. And, you know, they might say, well, you know, if you send us your Bitcoin, we'll double it for you. If you send us your Bitcoin, we'll trade it for you and you'll get profit. If you send us your Bitcoin, we'll store it securely for you, or we'll invest that in mining and you'll get guaranteed profits. Or, you know, we'll give you a new cryptocurrency and then you'll get X amount more coins or X amount of interest per, you know, day, week, month, or whatever the claims are. So they make all of these claims and sort of prey on people's desire to do well and, you know, to make money without really having to do an awful lot. And some of them grow really big. And I'd say the biggest, at least in my opinion, but probably in terms of number of people affected, the biggest problem in the crypto space is where you've got these crypto scams meet multi-level marketing, where it's sort of this commission-based incentivized structure whereby if you bring somebody in to invest, you get a really, really big fat commission, which goes down about 10 layers. So if the person you brought in then brings somebody else in to invest, you also get a commission, as do they, and so forth. So, you know, not only do people, you know, invest in the scam, but they're incentivized to bring everybody else in. And, you know, it's a bit grey who's guilty, you know, as any good Ponzi scheme, that, yeah, people who invest in early, they pay out. And there are some people who think that, you know, this is genuinely good, I'll bring all my friends and family in and all that. But a lot of these Ponzi schemes have got so big because of these sort of commission payouts using the multi-level marketing structure. So there's, you know, all these horrible stories of people bringing in all their friends and family and then feeling awful when everybody they know has lost money, but also religious leaders, community leaders, like promoting, like actually actively promoting scams to their congregations and communities. And then people, you know, trust religious leader or trust community leader or whatever it is and buy in. And, you know, there's horrible stories of, you know, next week religious leader turns up in big brand new big expensive car, and, you know, next month congregation loses all their money, and so that's been one of the problems. And you know, one could argue, and not enough people have been held accountable for promoting the scams.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting, when you go into the celebrity promotion of some of the coins and things like that, you know, where does accountability lie? Yeah. How do we, I guess, educate on the core principles of what a good solution versus a bad solution looks like?
Sorry, go on, you go. Well, no, I mean, just to say, social media has been really bad for that. I mean, TikTok is the platform sort of most commonly mentioned, but you've got, you know, these influencers getting, you know, really quickly millions of followers, and then you're promoting a scam or promoting some dodgy investment. And, you know, then you've had loads of stories where, you know, tons and tons of people have lost loads of money by following their advice because they trust the influencer. And then, you know, a week later, the influencer says, oh, sorry, I didn't realize it was a scam, I lost money too. But what they don't say is the influencer invested a tiny amount, you know, relatively tiny amount, and the, okay, what they lost doesn't really matter. But they got, you know, multiples of the amount that they invested in commission payouts off the back of people investing as a result. So not entirely honest.
No. Well, I guess it's interesting. We're actually, as a business, considering buying our first NFT at the moment. But okay. I think, interestingly, more on the community side, I think we're very interested in how we can access community-led engagement as opposed to perhaps what is commonly being referred to as a JPEG at the moment. I think there's some interesting considerations about actually, do you own the URL? Do you own the underlying image rights? Where does that sort of dissection appear? And actually, do people understand that? Or, you know, are they just saving to try and buy a Bored Ape at some point and praying that the ones they've bought in between are exciting enough? But
and it goes both ways. You've got lots of people who will end up losing a lot of money because they get into the NFT bandwagon and think, you know, it's the price is just going to keep going up, and then price doesn't keep going up and price goes down and people lose money. So you've got that speculative side of it. And, you know, one could argue that a lot of the NFTs have gone for more money than they're worth, you know, by several zeros. But also, like you say, there's the core use case, and, you know, NFTs, you know, show things like proof of purchase, proof of authenticity. You know, they show that actually this could correspond to something physical and this is real, and so actually bought this and so actually owns this. And
I think you can buy a house in New York at the moment, can you not? I think the first house
I didn't know that.
NFT, yeah.
Probably quite an expensive NFT, but at least it buys something.
A physical asset, yeah. Not that we can guarantee the house will go up in value either, I should probably add. But I guess if we look at, we've talked about so many different facets of crypto now, custody, NFTs, you know, asset classes. Do you think crypto has now taken off? Do you think it's had its inflection point, or do you think that's still to come? Like, where's your sense of its sort of penetration, I guess, for want of a better term?
I think it's totally still to come. I mean, you know, obviously we've had, you know, quite recently massive, massive price gains, and, you know, more and more people are getting into it. And, but, you know, I do think in terms of core use case and number of people using it, I think we're literally only just starting. And you know, yes, lots of people are in it, lots more aren't yet in it. And, you know, there's a few points to it. The infrastructure around crypto is developing incredibly quickly, like so quickly that you know, no one can really keep up with it. And, you know, that's great. You've now got institutional grade security, institutional grade custody platforms. You know, there's a lot of things cropping up that means it's a lot safer. You've now got lawyers working full time in sort of the crypto space and really understanding it and you know, working to make it more safe and secure. So, you know, that's changing really fast. And, you know, there is now a lot of more institutional sort of investment and interest getting into it. But on the other hand, in terms of sort of core number of users for, you know, everyday people using crypto for everyday purchases or use cases, but nowhere near. I mean, how often are you going to go into a whatever coffee shop or whatever shop you go into and pay for something practically in crypto? Like, not many people are going to do that, and not often. You know, the user experience is an awful lot better than it was 5 years ago. Is it good enough for my dad to just think, oh great, I'm going to buy some crypto and I'm going to make a payment in that? No sodding way. You know, and I think that still needs a lot of work. So, you know, things are happening. You know, there's now insurance for digital assets. There's a lot more happening around it. But I think we're still a long way away from it being a sort of a core payment use for, you know, the majority of people for, you know, regular sort of daily transactions. But I think that in some ways, that's only one event away. Correct, yeah. Facebook were working really hard to make that happen. They got stopped by regulators, and, you know, but partly what they were doing was, you know, slightly overambitious. Partly, I think there's not an overwhelming amount of trust in Facebook as a company to look after people's data or money. That's another podcast, and I'm not the best person to say that. But it only needs one company, one major player to bring out an idiot-proof crypto wallet, or to, you know, to say we're having crypto payments in whatever, or you can now send crypto via WhatsApp or whatever other messaging platform. So I think we're, in terms of user base, still so far, but I think it could be one big event that could change that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you look at Cash App and the Bitcoin that Square, Block, whatever, now owns, just to facilitate the P2P element of that.
Yeah.
Obviously, the explosion's happened. Do you think that event is generational to some extent? Like, I look at, I have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, and my 2-year-old talks to my Google Home like it's his best friend, and I can, like, the digital, you know, applicability of these solutions and the nativity, if that's not the right word, my children's ability to use digital technology, let's call it that, seems to be a much better place than mine was at certainly the age of 2.
Oh, totally. I mean, I think things are changing. I mean, you look at kids on social media and gaming and stuff now, and, you know, I can play a computer game to save my life, and, you know, every time I end up babysitting, I sort of regularly get thrashed by, you know, kids that come a little bit past my knee. So, totally.
So I think moving past my children and, you know, your inability to play computer games, if we talk about sort of more governmental structure and digitization of currency, CBDCs, they're obviously a quite common topic now. I think the FCA has put a pause on R1, but the US, the Yen, all of these sort of evolutionary, I guess, digital classes are now coming. I think
I guess there's two considerations to that. Do you think they're here because of COVID and the way people now pay for their products? And do you think there's tangible value in a CBDC versus holding a £10 note?
I think if one is a controlling, data-hungry, power-grabbing government, there's enormous value in having a CBDC. If one is an individual whose choice is having a, you know, £10 note, which, you know, to be fair, that they've checked isn't counterfeit, then I'd argue there's probably more value in a £10 note, or at least more safety in a £10 note. What's caused CBDC? I mean, I think for a few years, you know, before COVID, governments and payment providers had been doing what they could to make money more digital and to make it fully digital. And, you know, there's some valid arguments for that. A lot of physical cash is counterfeit, and, you know, a lot of energy goes into physically producing it, but also to checking that, you know, that this money is real. So, you know, that's one argument against physical cash. You know, and the point I often, you know, sort of make or perhaps emphasize is, you know, if you want to buy drugs, just as an example, you know, if you do so using Bitcoin, well, you know, that's probably the stupidest way you could buy drugs, because it's traceable, it's trackable. You know, you can see at this point X address and X transaction to Y address, and if Y address is linked to a dark web marketplace or a, you know, large drug dealer or whatever, then, you know, you can get found out. And likewise, if you send money digitally, as opposed to if you want to just meet in person and, you know, transfer whatever pound notes for drugs, and that's pretty private. So, you know, for governments and payment processes, there's big incentives to get rid of physical cash. It's also something that they don't really have like control over. I think there's a few points for the CBDCs. China has been working on theirs. I need to check the dates, but I believe about 8 years or so, give or take a year now. They're by far the most advanced in the world. In terms of the technology, how far they've got in terms of the trials that they've run out across China, you know, they're really advanced, and based on the trials that they've been running out, it's quite terrifying. You know, they've got this digital money where their own citizens can only make payments via certain apps. So, you know, you can't have physical cash. They don't have the concept there. You can't have, you know, a hidden away bank account. You know, your ability to make payments is linked to, you know, one or two digital apps, and that those are linked. And what they're trying to really sort of roll out as a, you know, as a mass national thing, is that your ability to make payments is linked to this app, only that app, and that's linked to a social score. So if you've got a, you know, below a certain social score, you can't physically make that payment. You can go on the train booking site, you can see what time trains there are, and you physically cannot book a train. You're blocked from doing so. If you've got below a social score, you can't get your kids into certain schools. It's, you know, you pay a higher interest. You've got all of these factors that are limited to people of a lower social score. You know, and likewise, if you've got a higher social score, you get priority booking, you get reduced interest rates, you don't have to pay deposits, you get your kids into better schools, and all of these things. You know, and I'd be of the mind to argue that things like one's ethnicity, one's sexuality, one's religion, one's political viewpoints, if one is a political journalist or writes certain things about the ruling party, who one associates with, what one buys, you know, certain factors like that, I would argue it's a bit scary to have those factors taken into account, and meaning that your transactions are blocked and you've no freedom, and that's what they're trying to do. So, you know, I find that quite scary. So if Western governments see that, you know, also see that how much more data and control the Chinese government will have over its citizens, and, you know, then they sort of feel that they have to compete. I'd argue that Facebook, with its DM launch, which was intended to be its own sort of stable cryptocurrency, was another factor. Not that Facebook sort of succeeded in its plan, or at least not yet, but I think governments and certainly corporates certainly took note. You've got a company that's got a third of the world's population using it on a regular basis. You know, Facebook has more users than any country by a long way, and, you know, have a lot of money to roll it out. And, you know, people saw, if, you know, I don't know, you pay me in Facebook coin, and then I pay somebody else in Facebook coin, and so on, so on, so on, which was what they were planning to do. What's the need for the central bank? Does that make Facebook the central bank? So I think Facebook was probably sort of a, you know, kick in the ass to sort of get up and look up and see what needs to be done. And then I think, you know, governments see CBDCs as a way to better control their population. And there's a certain, you know, good arguments for them. There's certain nations, you know, that are really looking at rolling out digital currencies to be able to better send benefits and better pay their citizens. You know, it means that, you know, most people would then have access to digital payments to be able to have things like microinsurance, microloans, receive benefits digitally, have, you know, benefits linked to only being able to buy medicines and not spend that on drugs or whatever. So, you know, there are benefits to it. I think I would argue that the ability to misuse the power that a CBDC gives to a government is terrifying. And, you know, anywhere is only ever one election away from having a complete and utter disaster in power, you know, as we've seen more than once in the West. You know, no comment about certain people in charge at the moment. So I find the power it would give quite scary.
Yeah, I understand that. I think it's it was a conversation very evident at the previous Money 2020. And for me, it felt like just some sense of banks, the sort of central banks trying to remain relevant in what was a more digitized environment. But I think it's, you know, cross-pollination of information and controlling people based on their ethnicity or gender or sexual preferences is not something that can ultimately
be. There's always a thing is once you've got the technology there that you can block transactions or that you can, you know, make payments easier or so forth for people, once that's in place, there's nothing in theory stopping governments or leaders from misusing that. And, you know, I've traveled around enough and, you know, most people are aware that you might have the most benign leader in the world who initiates a CBDC with good intentions, you know, within a matter of years is replaced by somebody with less benign intentions.
Do you think this problem, if we call it a problem or potential problem, let's call it, extends to crypto as a whole just on the basis of digitization, or do you think it's a CBDC problem?
I'd say that is a CBDC problem personally. I mean, if you think sort of look at the core principles of crypto, there's sort of the core, you know, sort of point of why, you know, one would argue that Bitcoin was launched. It was about giving people freedom to make payments, to send transactions, to store money without needing to rely on a third party. So I'd argue if you look at sort of the core principles of Bitcoin versus the core principles of CBDC, they're a totally different thing. I think what would be then worth saying is that not every cryptocurrency has stuck by the core principles of giving people sort of freedom and also transparency of payments. You know, I think there's a lot of cryptocurrencies that haven't done a lot of good for the industry.
Yeah. I think it's, we spoke a lot about this as a business in terms of our expansion and sort of things like PSD2 and how actually what you get is localized regulation. I'm not going to ask you to comment on individuality of regulation, but it feels like having a sort of umbrella principle framework that would allow people to innovate underneath would allow for a much better ecosystem to develop. The idea that innovation shouldn't be localized, it should be for something that is borderless, it should be a borderless, you know, regulatory structure. But anyway, let's talking through security a little bit. I think my perception, rightly or wrongly, when crypto first came around, that it was a sort of hero feature for it. We titled this hero or villain, but obviously, you know, you see the board Ape Yacht Club took, I think, a 300k hit over the weekend. You know, as we sort of established, there seems to be these more and more. Do you think security is a problem? I know you've talked about cybersecurity a bit, but do you think it's a problem or do you think it's just a human engagement?
I think both. I mean, I think one point to add is that crypto as an industry gets an enormous amount of hacks and exploits and scams and all of that. I don't think that's a problem unique to crypto. You know, all sorts of hacks and scams have gone up, especially since lockdown. with scammers taking advantage of everything. Ransomware has massively gone up. Scams have massively gone up. You know, my parents get a scam phone call pretty much every day. You know, just as an example, you know, there's all sorts of scams on social media platforms that nothing to do with crypto. So I'd say, you know, the scams and hacks in general have massively gone up, affecting, you know, a lot more outside of crypto. But sticking to crypto is a massive problem. And, you know, you've got sort of the one problem of projects and companies and cryptocurrencies and platforms that are, you know, either scams from start or at best, you know, dubious in intent, where, you know, they're sort of directly to blame. But then you've also got a whole lot of others that, you know, I think have got away with making good claims and having good marketing so that, you know, people might think I trust them. And, you know, it's you know, understandable to see why people might take things at face value, because, you know, in normal life, one likes to think one can do that. But there have been a lot of platforms that, you know, have perhaps oversold what they offer or oversold the security, and that just haven't taken the core, you know, basic sort of security measures that they could have done to do things like store the crypto that they hold for their investors securely. There are secure ways of storing crypto that are seen as being institutionally sort of safe, where, you know, there haven't been known cases of that crypto being stolen. And then there are other ways of storing crypto, such as, you know, online or in, you know, hot accessible wallets that are less safe for storing it in centralized platforms. So, you know, I'd say a lot of the faults, yes, there's been lots of hacks. And, you know, I'd argue that some of these projects make so much money that one would have thought that using a bit of that to get the world's best penetration testers, the world's best cybersecurity experts, the world's best sort of, you know, almost ethical hackers to check their code, to check their technology, to check how they store their NFTs or where they store their NFTs or how they send them or all of that. So, I would argue that a lot is down to almost human laziness or human not wanting to spend as much money as they could do to make everything secure. And then some are just, you know, they just didn't know that they would get hacked or exploited. So yeah, I don't think it's a black and white area, but I think it's an enormous problem, you know, that could be solved in big part by investing a lot more in security that is available.
What are some of the exciting things that you see going on in this space? Like what are some of the things that are, you know, happy times for the crypto space versus some of the...
Oh gosh, I mean, every day. I mean, you know, I personally couldn't care less the price of Bitcoin goes up or down or whatever. But, you know, there's so many super cool projects out there. You know, my favorite one out there is still, it's called Plastic Bank. So it's you know, just as, you know, in what is really a super simple use case, there's a problem with people around the world chucking out waste plastic, and in many countries waste plastic isn't seen as having any value. So, you know, they get plastic bottle, and then, you know, when they're done with plastic bottle, we'll chuck away plastic into the environment or into the sea or into the whatever countryside, because who cares? There's no value attached to it. And, you know, people are more focused on, well, I need to make money to survive, or, you know, whatever. They don't care about the waste plastic. So there's been certain initiatives with companies trying to pay people to collect the waste plastic. But, you know, two core problems with that: A, that the world price of plastic fluctuates. So, you know, what they get paid one day might be less than another day, and then they cry scam and don't trust the sort of the plastic collecting company. You know, another problem has been, well, if you collect recycled plastic and, you know, well, collect waste plastic and then recycle it, how do you actually know that's recycled plastic? You know, there's a big scam, I believe it was in China, where factories making new plastic and shredding it and selling it as recycled plastic, because it's cheaper to create new plastic and shred it than it is to recycle waste plastic. You know, and then also the plastic collectors were getting paid in cash, you know, which was, you know, a bit useless. And, you know, these are people that don't have access to traditional banking, so there was no other way to pay them. So they were paying them in cash, and, you know, heard stories of basically gangs of guys waiting outside where they got paid just to jump on the women and steal the money, or drunken husbands when they got home taking the money. So, you know, that's not ideal there either. So plastic bank, you know, quite simply some two things that they record the plastic collection on blockchain, so that they, you know, that they can prove without needing to get into tech, they can prove that this plastic was collected here and it was waste plastic and then it was turned into recycled plastic. So companies pay a premium, so they can always pay a premium and stable price to the plastic collectors. And they've created a digital wallet for their plastic collectors. But you're not talking a massive project that's going on in multiple countries. So, you know, people that may not have access to banking, but will have access to a smartphone, cheap smartphone, so they can have a digital wallet and then they get paid in digital tokens, which for the first time means that they can, you know, either swap those for food or school fees or whatever, or save money for the first time and then get a credit score for the first time. So they can get microloans, they can get mortgages, they can get insurance, they can put down deposits on things. So it opens up like total amount of financial freedom just on the simple factor of plastic bank, you know, giving digital wallets and paying people digital tokens, you know. And that's nothing to do with the price of Bitcoin or anything. It's just such a simple use case, but, you know, super cool. And then there's, you know, other platforms doing things like same kind of thing. Micro insurance isn't available to a lot of people. Disaster insurance isn't available to a lot of people because the cost of taking, you know, physical cash to people who don't have access to banking is often more than the payout would be. The stories in Indonesia, if there was a volcano goes off or whatever, if people claimed insurance, it would cost more to fly the money to them in a helicopter than the payout would be worth. So there's now a project being worked on to create, again, digital wallets and pay people in digital tokens so they can send that immediately and solve the problem. So that's the type of thing I get excited by. In the industry, and, you know, thankfully, you know, with the work at CMS and through the community, you end up hearing about a lot of those projects.
Yeah, I'm going to have a look at Plastic Bank, so shout out to them. And I think
they're super.
Yeah,
cool.
I think I guess we won't have time on this one, but, you know, financial inclusion is a subject that I think super important, and one I think that, you know, this sort of type of product can really lend itself to. I think the examples you gave ultimately sort of fall under that bracket to some extent. So I think, you know, a very positive, I guess, use case for some of these things. But on the basis that we're running out of time, I believe, I'll get shouted at. I think one of the things, obviously, we try and ask everyone on this podcast, irrelevant of their expertise, I think, is just a bit, it's just a single question, but I'd be interested to hear your response. Sort of in fintech, what is yet to happen? Fintech as a whole, you can relate it to crypto, but so what's the thing that's yet to happen that's exciting or gets you out of bed in the morning?
I think mass use of crypto will be one thing. You know, I think it won't be long before, and, you know, it doesn't need to be crypto in the sort of the Bitcoin or volatile sense. It could be just a stable currency that's actually trusted. But, you know, I think it won't be long. You know, currently, if you go on WhatsApp, you know, you can send messages, photos, videos, you know, audio things, files, whatever. Can't send money. So I think that will be probably the next big thing that will sort of change how payments work. I mean, just, you know, an example, if we go out and you buy me an ice cream and I, you know, I want to send you a pound for the ice cream you bought me, or probably £2 like, in inflation, or three or four. But you know what I mean? If I want to pay you back for that ice cream or whatever it is, how do I do that? You know, it's you know, does one log on to one's bank? That's a bit of an ask. Well, PayPal blocks most people, bit of an ask. How would I give you that, you know, one or four, whatever it is, pounds or those micro amounts? You know, as opposed to, I do believe that in the near future, there'll be a thing on messaging platforms where instead of just being able to send photos and files, it'll be a, you know, send you £1 out of my digital wallet, or, you know, likewise for paying for content. At the moment, it's subscription based because they haven't quite worked out the sort of the micropayments thing. I do believe we'll see in the not too near future a way where we can just, instead of, you know, having to pay £10 a month to subscribe to whatever newspaper or blog or whatever it is, we can just pay X amount of pence to read this article or watch that video or whatever it is. And you're talking in sort of the micropayments there. So I think that would be quite cool to see.
Well, I promise next time I see you, I'll bring you an ice cream. You don't have to pay for it.
All right, a vegan ice cream, please. But thank you, Alex. That's kind. I'll take you up on that. I'll remember that.
I think just before we say goodbyes, obviously, you know, you have a wonderful book out there. So I think, I don't know if I'm allowed to do this, but my marketing team might tell me off, but we'll cover the sort of the first 10. So if you message anyone that's got this far the podcast, and I appreciate it, if you message Erica or myself, Erica will tell you where to get hold of her in just a second. With just the word tribe, we'll send you a copy, and Erica, I'll work out how to buy those off you in a minute, because this wasn't planned.
Thank you so much.
No worries at all. But just tell us where we can find a bit more about you, a bit more about Curry, I guess, from the earliest ages and the book.
Yeah, so the website is cryptocurryclub.com, and we've got a presence on LinkedIn. So either type my name, Erica Stanford, or Crypto Curry Club onto LinkedIn, and should be able to follow us there and see updates about our events. We've got a weekly newsletter that goes out every Tuesday morning, the Crypto Courier, which sort of goes through, summarizes the main news and events in the crypto space, and, you know, keeps it sort of super brief and easy reading. And the aim is that within 10 minutes, anybody can have an overview of all of the main things that's happened that week, and, you know, not look stupid in conversation. At least that's my aim with it. The book, it's Crypto Wars, that's available. I mean, either directly from the publisher Kogan Page or from Amazon, Waterstones, W.O. Smith, or good retailers. So, I mean, type Crypto Wars and my name into Google, and Google will show you where it is.
All good retailers.
I think that's what the publisher told me to say.
Yeah, exactly. Very on brand. But no, listen, it's been a pleasure to speak to you today, and a very easy and, you know, interesting conversation for me. So thank you for educating me and our listeners. And hopefully we'll have you back on at some point to have a bit more of a deep dive on some other bits.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I'm looking forward to the ice cream now.
Yeah, I'll have to write that down so I don't forget. Awesome. Thanks, everyone. Cool.